Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Oh, welcome in. You are listening to the weekend edition of the KE Report. My name is Corey Fleck, and I am your host for the full 2 hours this weekend. Al is taking a little break from the KER Politics weekend show, so you are getting 2 full hours of market and economic commentary. In the first hour, we are going to be focusing more on broad economies and broad markets, with the second hour diving more into the resource sector, talking about some companies, but also looking at jurisdictions and some of the opportunities, not just in the precious metals that we see. That being said, I am kicking off the show with Mike Larson. You can follow Mike on Twitter at RealMikeLarson. Mike also writes the Safe Money Report. And Mike, you and I have been talking quite a bit over the last now over a year about the change in strategy when it comes to markets. And it was all, I think, being driven home a little bit more just a couple weeks ago when we really started to get some of that weak data out of the U.S. The ISM number was weak. We also saw a jobs number that, yes, unemployment did go down, but we are seeing a general slowdown in hirings. Recap some of the recent data that has creeped into the U.S. that rightfully so should be concerning for investors and even for the politicians and central bankers.
Sure. You know, we've been talking for quite some time, as you noted, about messages coming from the yield curve, the treasury market, a dramatic flattening of the treasury yield curve that was persistent, consistent, very severe. As a matter of fact, in terms of the magnitude of the flattening of the curve this time, it's the second most we've seen since the late 1980s. Basically, it's flattened more and inverted more than at any pre-recession period, except for right before the dot-com bust. So yes, that includes the sort of savings and loan and oil-driven bust in the early 90s. It includes the housing and mortgage bust in the mid-2000s. So you're going to get, you've been getting for a long time now, you know, several quarters now, a signal from the bond market that the investors expect the economy to weaken. Now you're seeing the data begin to confirm that. If you look over the last several weeks, you know, ISM, the manufacturing index, was the worst in 10 years. The services sector index was the worst since 2016. So you're seeing, you know, the original manufacturing sector of the economy begin to roll over just like you would kind of expect, given what's going on in the trade and tariff and global growth scenario where all that's slowing down. And now you're seeing this start to spread over to services, which, you know, all the apologists who say the bond market and the yield curve, you know, it's different this time, blah, 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 you know, said, oh, well, services and consumer spending will hold up. But that's not really how this works, and it's not how it works historically. You tend to see, you know, manufacturing begin to slip first, then you see services activity begin to slow, and then you see employment begin to turn. What we've seen in the most recent jobs figures is, yes, unemployment rate is low, but the pace of job creation is down about almost 30% from a year ago. In terms of the monthly average jobs created this year versus in 2018, is down about 30%. So it's still adding jobs, but adding fewer jobs. And even within the jobs report, you saw the sectors like manufacturing and retail begin to actually shed jobs. In fact, manufacturing has happened more than once. Retail lost jobs. And that's the kind of stuff that you would expect in a pre-recessionary environment. I'm not as bearish as some people who say we're actually potentially in recession now, but I think all the evidence points to that being the case beginning sometime in the first half of 2020. So I don't think it's very far around the corner. And I think that's why you've seen, you know, what we've discussed before. I mean, the stocks and the sectors that are winning in the last 18 months or so are not the same stocks and sectors that were winning in the bull market period. It was all the offensive growth type things, transports, financials, small caps, and all that that were winning. They're losing now. They're dramatically underperforming. Meanwhile, you're seeing things like utilities, REITs, consumer staples, treasuries, gold, gold miners, all that stuff that does better in a higher volatility, lower growth, pre-recessionary environment is doing better. So you've had to shift your strategy as an investor if you want to continue to profit in this market. Just owning the indexes is a loser strategy. It's now been 21 months in a row where or basically a 21-month long period where the S&P 500 has done nothing. You've earned 10 times as much in gold mining stocks to some degree, or gold itself is outperforming the S&P dramatically. Treasuries are up something like 5 to 6 times as much as the stock market in the last 12 months. And I'll just tell you something. That's very different from what we saw before. And it means you've got to change your investing approach if you still want to make money in the market we have now, not the one that we had 2 years ago.
Yeah, very true. And also remember, we did have that yield curve inversion. It was very short, but that happened a few months ago, and that predicts usually a recession a year to two out. So that could all tie in with next year's recession. I want to get some quick comments from you regarding the comments made by Jerome Powell this week, where he discussed the expansion of the Fed balance sheet. We've already seen the balance sheet grow by about, well, just over $100 billion. And he's saying that expansion could continue, but he's not labeling this a QE program. To me, that seems like a bit of a disconnect in just playing with words. Either way, the Fed seems to be expanding their balance sheet, whether it's in the repo market or somewhere else that we don't know. What was your takeaway from this balance sheet expansion and seemingly Fed wanting to or willing to expand it even more?
Sure. Well, first, just to briefly close the loop on the yield curve issue, what I follow most closely, because historically it's been the best curve measure in terms of predicting recession, is the difference in yield between the three-month Treasury bill and the 10-year Treasury note. That three-month 10-year spread actually first inverted this year in March, popped out of that for a couple weeks, then re-inverted and has been in inverted territory now for about seven total months. That's roughly similar to what we saw, again, in the periods preceding the dot-com bust, preceding the housing bust, and preceding the early 90s recession. So, and you know, it's not just that it inverted, it's that it was collapsing in terms of from the widest spread to the lowest to date inversion level. It's been 424 basis points, 4.25 percentage points. That's huge. Again, in magnitude, that's the worst flattening we've seen, with the exception of the pre-dot-com bust flattening in 30 years. So noteworthy there. As far as the Fed, now, you know, Jerome Powell is out there saying, oh, this is going to be like 2015, 2016, where the economy slowed because of the oil patch bust, and then it got back on its feet. And he's also comparing this to 1995 and 1998. 98 was when we had sort of the long-term capital management meltdown, and the curve temporarily inverted, the Fed cut a couple of times, and that was followed by that dramatic boom that, you know, ultimately led to the dot-com bust. And then 94, 95, when the Fed achieved its only soft landing in the last 30-some-odd years. That's wishful thinking. He's wrong. The curve is behaving differently. Indicators are pointing in a different direction. So, yeah, you know, which he's not going to say. No Fed chairman is ever going to say, yeah, we screwed up and we're probably heading into recession. They just don't do that. But you're getting the same kind of happy talk you've gotten before that I think is just wrong. With regards to sort of this QE, no QE thing, what the Fed's going to do is now it's basically throwing in the towel on QT, quantitative tightening. You know, for years and years, it was saying, oh, sure, we're going to normalize the balance sheet. We're going to get back to kind of the same policy we had before the big Great Recession. And part of that was shrinking the balance sheet. But after just about a year of doing so, and, you know, only, I think, unwinding about a third of what it added during the QE days, the Fed's basically saying, you know what, the economy's not good enough. It's leading to turmoil in the repo market. We can't do it after all, so we're going to start expanding the balance sheet. But, and this is absolutely crucial, this is not the same style of QE that you saw in 1, 2, and 3, number one. Number two, 3 was less effective than 2, and 2 was less effective than 1. So, A, this is not really QE4. They're going to be using the very short end of the yield spectrum, and they're basically just going to be, you know, covering short-term overnight needs. It's not massively growing the balance sheet. And B, even if the Fed did it at this point, what would happen? You'd see basically long-term yields collapse, intermediate-term yields collapse, and investors not want to buy the same stuff they bought in the last cycles. The reason QE worked in the first place, if by worked you mean inflated risky assets, is that risk was extreme at extreme levels back then. When you think back to just out of the recession, QE worked in collapsing risk spreads and driving stocks up because stocks were extremely cheap. Risk spreads, meaning, you know, the yields on junk bonds versus treasuries and all that, were extremely wide. The market was primed for a rebound because assets were cheap. None of that's true today. It's the exact opposite. Stocks are extremely expensive. Spreads are very low. You know, we're 11 years into this base, or essentially into this economic expansion and bull market that kind of started dying out in January of 2018. So it's the completely wrong policy for the completely wrong point in the cycle. And that's not even what they're doing yet. I have no doubt that at some point, the Fed may try and pull that out again, but that's not going to happen until we roll over into a new bear market, in my opinion.
Okay, and that's what I know a lot of people are waiting for is when will this bear market happen? But also regarding a recession, 2020, a lot of people are saying too that, you know, that's right during the election or at least that long election season that the U.S. has. And Trump arguably does control a pretty big card if he can get some sort of a trade deal done and provide, even if it is just a short little boost, could be a boost to the markets and to just general confidence, especially out of businesses. What do you have to say to that argument?
You know, it's funny. There is a lot of talk, you're right, that heading into an election, the sitting president who's up for re-election is not going to let it happen, you know, come heck or high water. The reality is, look what happened when Obama was trying to get elected. You know, the economy was falling apart in the last cycle. Look what happened in the 2000, 2001, 2002 period. That was, you know, the economy was falling apart right around the time of an election. We're heading into recession. You know, the reality is there's not much you can do when the economic and credit cycle turn is part of it. So first of all, you can't have as much of an impact as you think you can, even if you want to. That's the first part of it. Second part of it is, why would the Democrats even go along with something aggressive if Donald Trump wanted to get something through that would help his election chances? They wouldn't. So you have political resistance to that. That's the second part of it. And the third part of it is, where's the money going to come from? In most economic expansions, the government sort of steps back, you know, and instead of spending a bunch of money, takes in a lot more tax revenue that refills the coffers. And heading into a recession, it then has the sort of financial wherewithal to step in and provide a lot of aid to counter the weakness. But we didn't do that at all. This economic expansion, we were running $600, $700, $800 billion a year deficits up to $1 trillion throughout this economic expansion. There was no rebuilding of the balance sheet health of Uncle Sam, for example. And there was no, you know, again, sort of refilling the coffers for the downside. So at this point, how is there going to be a big fiscal aid package? I mean, the money just isn't there. And, you know, we also kind of had this huge corporate tax cut, which helped goose growth in the short term. But a lot of that money was just squandered on stock buybacks and financial engineering and so on by corporate America. It wasn't spent on actual productive investment, building factories, you know, increasing R&D spending and so on. So a lot of money was squandered. There was no sort of refilling the kitty during the boom times. And that means we're heading into this impending recession, neither able to nor really having the willpower and ability to get something passed. So I think it's going to be, you know, it's about rockier road heading into this than we did have heading into the last couple of downturns in terms of what the fiscal side of the equation can actually do.
Well, that's also because we just have such low interest rates. And yeah, even as you said, these companies didn't kind of refresh the coffer over this last bull market. All they did was buy back stock and essentially take on more debt at low interest rates. So the low interest rate aspect does help them. But it's not like companies are saying we need lower interest rates to help us spend more. They're saying that we're uncertain about global growth. And in all fairness, we were seeing slow global growth even before kind of this chaos with trade wars happened. So these type of tools and these type of businesses, which are crucial, they're not seeing a whole lot of opportunity for growth. That needs to be a major concern, doesn't it?
No, it absolutely does. That's it. That's a big part of it. And, you know, I would also add that there's kind of this misconception. A lot of people, you know, sort of the Wall Street narrative is, oh, if it wasn't for this trade war, you know, if it wasn't for Trump getting into a fight with China, everything would be fine. That's just not right. The trade and tariff situation is clearly contributing to the downturn we're seeing on a global scale. But you also, if you look at the economy, you're seeing bank lending demand weaken. You're seeing credit standards begin to tighten. You're seeing credit spreads, meaning the extra risk cost that you have to take on as a company looking to borrow. Those have been widening since January 2018. You look at the auto sector, for example, it's been kind of lackluster demand there. I mean, you know, you have lenders giving out 108-month car loans and they're still not goose sales very much. Housing, it's, you know, better somewhat because of the interest rate decline, but really not anywhere near the sort of growth engine that it was in the last cycle. So even domestically, there's not a lot to point to. And you throw in the fact that sort of the one part that was working really well, this VC-funded tech boom bubble, whatever you want to call it, now that's starting to pop. That's going to have a negative impact on growth in a lot of these metros in terms of jobs, housing markets, commercial real estate demand, and so on in places like Seattle, San Francisco, Boston, New York. There's going to be issues there, too. So it all sort of paints a picture of an economy that's in trouble, that is not yet in recession, but that almost every indicator I follow kind of points to the fact that that's where we'll be next year.
Now, what about your thoughts on the IPO market, too? We've seen some pretty high-name IPOs not skyrocket after coming into the market, actually be sold off quite aggressively, and even the recent news of WeWork not even being able to get their IPO done. This is another sign, too, that there was a lot of money made in this sector, this area, but it seems to be drying up, and there just doesn't seem to be as much money available to take these really risky companies even further into, well, unicorn territory. What's your thoughts on this?
I mean, I could go on and on about that, and I'll try and keep it relatively brief. I used to work at a dot-com in the late 1990s. I graduated from college in 98 and went right to work for one. So I've seen this movie before. I know how the process works. I know what happens on the downside when it comes to layoffs and you know, spending cuts. And so all that optimism that gets, you know, burst and all that silly behavior that seems so smart at the peak of the bubble, you know, 2 years later, you look back and say, what the heck were people thinking? That's exactly what we're seeing this time around. We had the highest percentage of money losing IPOs in history last year. 85% of the companies that came public were losing money in the 12 months before their IPO. That was even worse than we saw at the peak of the dot-com bubble. What's interesting is that, you know, now everybody's talking about and seeing what's happening to Uber and Lyft and WeWork and Slack and all these companies whose stocks after their IPOs have been falling, or in the case of WeWork, can't even launch the IPO. But a lot, just like in the dot-com cycle, a lot of the garbage second-tier and third-tier companies back then began to collapse in the second half of 1999. The big names and then the NASDAQ itself didn't even really notice until, you know, the second or first and second quarter of 2000. So it was already happening behind the scenes then, and it's happening now. I mean, some of the crop or some of the IPOs that came out in the second half of 2018 and, you know, or spring of 2018, they had terrible fundamentals. And as soon as they came public, they started falling. You had these big one or, you know, one day or 1 week or 1 month pops. They're down from their post-IPO peak, 60, 70, 80%. One or two have already been delisted or are close to it. So, you know, yes, now we're hearing about it with the Ubers and Lyfts and WeWorks of the world. But this deterioration behind the scenes was already happening. It's just gaining steam and now sweeping up the bigger names, which is exactly, again, what you saw in the dot-com bust. And it's going to have a significant negative impact on the economy and the markets going forward.
All right, let's just wrap it up with kind of that portfolio management that we have talked about a number of times. Yes, sticking to some of these safer sectors as well as more recession-protected sectors. But that being said, if a recession does hit and really take hold, what needs to be the strategy then? Because some of these sectors also can get hit quite hard if there's a big liquidity squeeze and rush to cash.
Sure. I have this thing that I call my boring stock screener. I do it using the tools at the Weiss Ratings website. And I can just look at, you know, how different sectors, different ETFs, different stocks are performing. And, you know, in the last 12 months, the GDX, the VanEck Gold Miners ETF, is up more than 48%. The TLT, which owns treasury bonds, is up 31%. REITs are up 26%. Gold itself is up 26%. Utilities, 23%. Consumer staples, 16%. I mean, that tells you what's been working in this market, and that tells you what the market behind the scenes, behind just, you know, what the S&P 500 is doing, values in this market. They value steady growth, dividends, lower volatility, pre-recessionary business models. Meanwhile, the transportation ETF is down 9.5%. Financials are down 1%. And the S&P 500 has basically gone nowhere. At some point, and you saw this in the dot-com cycle, at some point, even those sort of winners, those dividend type payers, eventually, if the whole market rolls over, they get dragged down too. We have not yet seen it. I am watching for it. And some of these names in the most recent couple of weeks in Safe Money Report, our flagship newsletter, I've taken a few, half profits on a few of these names. I've sort of lowered the exposure overall because we may be getting close to that period. But for right now, it's, you know, you can still find select opportunities if you're careful, if you focus in those sectors, you find the names with high Weiss ratings, stable dividends, and so on. But again, at some point, you're going to have to even raise significantly higher levels of cash, add more hedges, and basically move almost completely to the sideline.
All right. Hey, Mike, always great chatting with you. Again, if you want to follow along with Mike, easily done on Twitter, @RealMikeLarson. Also, if you want more information on Mike and his newsletters, which include the Safe Money Report, please email me, fleck@kereport.com. Mike, it's great chatting with you. Thanks for taking time on this weekend show. Have a great rest of your weekend.
Great. You too. Thank you.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.